This episode of Lawyers Tell All is brought to you by the Intake Academy. Are you ready to convert more callers to qualified cases, rapidly qualify good cases, and transform unqualified prospects to advocates for your firm, whether you're able to handle their case or not? Visit www.intakeacademy.com and discover how to cement relationships with more of your ideal clients. Get them to commit to you and send you more referrals than you ever thought possible. Welcome to the Lawyers Tell All podcast, where Chris Mullins, the preeminent sales and communications consultant in the legal industry, shows you how it looks through lawyers' eyes. Here, innovators in the trenches provide powerful insights that help you connect with new clients, handle the sometimes harsh realities of the legal profession, and embrace the mindsets needed to succeed. Be sure to visit our website at www.lawyerstellall.com. And while you're there, subscribe to us via your favorite network. Now, lean in, tune in, and let's take a deep dive.
Everyone, it's Chris Mullins with Lawyers Tell All, and today I'm interviewing Talmash Boston, and I'm going to let Talmash tell you a little bit about himself. Go ahead.
Well, hello to this audience, and my name's Talmash Boston. I'm a lawyer in Dallas. I've been practicing law, specializing in commercial litigation for 45 and a half years, graduated University of Texas undergrad and law school, came to Dallas right out of law school and been here ever since. My vocation, as I said, is commercial litigator. I'm past chairman of the business litigation section of the Dallas Bar, the litigation section of the State Bar of Texas, been very involved with both my local and state bar associations through the years, and have been board certified in both civil trial law and civil appellate law for over 30 years by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization. My avocation is writing history. My fifth book comes out on April 2nd, 2024, and it's called How the Best Did It, Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents. And it has eight chapters on our eight best presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, both Roosevelt's, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Reagan. Each chapter attempts to identify typically the three most important leadership traits that made that president successful. And at the end of each chapter is what I call a mini workbook of questions for the reader to ask him or herself about how he or she is doing in the area of the three traits that he just read about in the preceding chapter. So the target audience is anybody who is or aspires to be a leader in any organization. My first two books were on baseball history. 1939, Baseball's Tipping Point. The foreword was written by John Grisham, the novelist. The second, Baseball and the Baby Boomer, a history commentary and memoir. Foreword by Frank DeFord, the great NPR commentator and sports writer of the year so many times. My third one was what I call a lawyer encouragement book called Raising the Bar, the Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society, that was published by the State Bar of Texas. And the fourth and the fifth have both been about presidential history. My earlier presidential history book was titled Cross-Examining History, A Lawyer Gets Answers from the Experts About Our Presidents. And Ken Burns from New Hampshire wrote the foreword of that book. So anyway, I'm 70 years old. With each passing year, I do a little less law and a little more history. One of the things that I do in Dallas is when leading authors and historians come through town on their book tours, I will typically interview them in front of live audiences and record them. And I have a podcast series called Cross-Examining History. And I've done programs with John Grisham, David Brooks, David McCullough, John Meacham, Evan Thomas, Doug Brinkley, all the leading presidential historians. Been doing that for about 5.5 years. And they're on Spotify, SoundCloud, iTunes, and the website of the Washington Independent Review of Books, for whom I write book reviews. And so kind of have a two careers, a legal career and a history career.
Yeah, and a writing career,
Yeah.
right? How did that whole thing happen? How did the writing and the history, how did that happen?
Well, I always loved history, and even as a child growing up and all the way through, and I come from a family of history lovers, and of course, commercial litigators, trial and appellate, do a lot of writing. I got a little bit tired into my career. It seemed like I was writing for too small of an audience, and too many of the times I'd go into court and the judge would obviously have not read anything I'd written. I hope our New Hampshire, your New Hampshire judges are better than many of our Texas judges in that respect. I was really heavily into baseball and baseball history in the 1990s, and that led to my first book. And I am not a musical artist. I'm not a graphic artist, but I like to think I have at least some creativity. And so writing for publication turned out to be a good outlet where I could use some creativity and give myself a platform above and beyond the lawyer platform that has opened the door to so many relationships. That's how I got to know John Grisham. That's how I got to know David Brooks. That's how I got to know U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito, and many, many others through our mutual love of baseball. And it's all interwoven together in terms of what I do as a lawyer, as well as what I do as a historian. I'm next week with a book coming out. I'm going to be speaking all over the country, and I need to obviously be in a good public speaking mode, as I need to be whenever I'm in the courtroom. And so the traits are actually very similar. I mean, to do the research that I do, I obviously have to ask a lot of questions. And to do the interviews I do, I have to ask a lot of questions. And of course, as a lawyer examining witnesses, I have to ask a lot of questions. So really the skill sets for my vocation and my avocation are very similar.
So the book that tell us a little bit about the book. I mean, I know you did a few moments ago, but get into it a little bit more as far as the book that's coming out April 2nd.
Well, obviously, here in 2024, we are in a presidential election year, and obviously, and we have a very difficult choice to make. Our last two presidents have not exactly been superstars, and America is suffering from a lack of knowing its history. In fact, as Ken Burns likes to say, that most people can't remember the first name of their high school history teacher, or the last name of their high school history teacher, but they remember the first name, which was coach. So much of history is taught by coaches, and coaches are great typically, and coaches, not many of them are great history teachers. So anyway, there's less history majors, liberal arts majors in America's colleges, and it's all unfortunate because we have so many great historians turning out wonderful history books these days. So I say that my personal mission is to be a missionary and an ambassador for the study of history, both through what I write about, but also through the on-stage interview programs and my podcast series to promote our leading historians and what's contained in their books and how, in fact, the new book, How the Best Did It, the guy who wrote the foreword is John Avlon. John, until about 6 weeks ago, was the lead political analyst for CNN in the morning. His wife is Margaret Hoover, as in Margaret Hoover's firing line on PBS. But John Avlon has also written two wonderful presidential biographies, one on George Washington and one on Abe Lincoln. And he says what he wants to be in the business of is, quote, applied history. It's one thing to know history. It's something else to be able to apply it to your daily living. And that's really what my book aspires to be. Take these greatest American leaders in our history and exactly what it was that made them great, with the idea that if people have an appreciation for that, maybe they can apply those things to their own efforts at leadership whether it's a business, a law firm, a hospital, a nonprofit, whatever it may be, these leadership traits are truly timeless and worthy of attention and study and hopefully emulation.
Yeah, I love that. You don't have a copy of your book at all with you right there, do you? Let's see it. Okay, well, open up your book to any page at all.
Yeah.
And read something to us.
Well, here's at the very end, after I cover the eight chapters, then I have what I call my closing thoughts paragraph to kind of summarize. And at the end of those closing thoughts, I try to speculate on if we brought these eight presidents back to life and they visited American politics in 2024, what would they have to say based on what we know about their political careers and their perspectives and their priorities? And so that's how I end my closing thoughts chapter. I chose John Avalon to write my foreword because in his books on Washington and Lincoln, he impressed me as today's master of applied history, which he defines as, quote, not simply the study of what happened, but why it happened, and how the answers to those questions can guide us now. Useful wisdom is the goal, close quote. In the spirit of John's commitment to making sure a knowledge of history can help guide us in making decisions regarding today's most important issues, I will now use the information contained in the prior chapters as the basis for providing my best guess at what each of these presidents would say now if given a one-sentence limit to tell Americans today what would be on their hearts if they looked at our present circumstances. George Washington, quote, because we Americans had the wisdom, integrity, perseverance, and strength to declare our independence from England, then win that independence in the Revolutionary War, then create the new government model finalized in the Constitution, and finally move forward with a checks and balances system that has now lasted more than two centuries, the challenges presented today clearly pale in comparison to those we prevailed over in my era, and therefore they can be met, close quote. Thomas Jefferson. For those who believe today's political polarization presents an insurmountable problem to effective governments, don't just stand there and complain about it. Instead, make it your job to build positive relationships with those who hold opposing views, just as I did repeatedly throughout my presidency in the aftermath of the Sedition Act to bring down the walls that divided and threatened to destroy America's house, close quote. Abraham Lincoln, quote, anyone can go low and do harsh things when major conflicts arise over deciding what is best for the future. But what separates Americans from the rest of the world is our longstanding commitment to take the high road whenever problems arise and then make good decisions about how to solve them, guided by the better angels of our conscience. Theodore Roosevelt, quote, even though I always savored the short time I spent with the Rough Riders in the Cuban battlefield, I also learned the hard way about the devastating loss and anguish of war by knowing what it did to two of my sons in World War I, which has resulted in my sincere belief that prudent people must always fully explore every available diplomatic option before making the decision to declare war on an enemy. Franklin Roosevelt, quote, never underestimate the power of the human spirit in a person. And a great nation to triumph over adversity and evolve one step at a time toward making sound decisions through the process of reflection and heeding the advice of sage counsel. Dwight Eisenhower, quote, human endeavors of any size have the best chance of succeeding if the person at the top puts into place a support team of competent people who can give the leader what he needs to allow him to make the best decisions, which means that a person in charge who opts to make decisions and pursue challenges by himself or in a mode of disorganization is surely traveling on the road to disaster. John F. Kennedy, quote, "To be in the best position to lead people forward to new and better heights requires the courage to learn what you don't know, listen with discernment to advice that may or may not be correct, and recognize that final decisions about how best to deal with crucial issues often involve moral imperatives and not just political considerations." And last but not least, Ronald Reagan, quote, "There will always be plenty of pessimists and naysayers who do their best to block progress, and history largely forgets or ignores them. But if a leader has beliefs and vision that will produce a brighter future for his people, no critic should have the power to block him from achieving his goals." Quote, close quote. So just as Lou Cannon, a noted journalist and historian, Reagan biographer, just as Lou Cannon determined that the presidency was, quote, "the role of a lifetime for Ronald Reagan, outside of my commitments to faith, family, and friends, I believe that putting the facts and thoughts together in this book have been the most important role of my lifetime." Here's hoping you've enjoyed and learned from reading the final product as much as I enjoyed and learned from researching and writing it. So that's how my book ends.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. That's exciting.
But my book has been thoroughly tested. It's endorsed on the dust jacket by three Pulitzer Prize winners, John Meacham, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and Annette Gordon Reed, as well as leading presidential historians, Doug Brinkley, Mark Updegrove, Evan Thomas, Ronald White, Will N. Bowden, and David Stewart. And for each of the eight chapters, I had at least two major biographers of that president read the chapter, tweak it, give me his thoughts. Did I miss anything? Did I misstate anything? So the conclusions in the book have been thoroughly vetted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel, and you know, dust jacket endorsements from Pulitzer Prize winners will hopefully persuade readers that this is a book worthy of their consideration.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. I look forward to getting a copy of it. So let me see here. I'm looking at my notes, and you have a couple of the different chapters. One is, want to know how to take the high road when major problems arise? Do what Lincoln did.
Yeah, that's the trait of what I call, or I think the accurate word is magnanimity, which is taking the high road, which is being big, even when you're frustrated and angry and everything else. And he exemplified this throughout his presidency. Obviously, we had the Civil War, and originally the Union generals led by McClellan disrespected Lincoln, thought he didn't know what he was doing. They were West Point grads. He had less than 1 year of formal schooling, although he immediately started studying military history and strategy when he realized that they weren't very good at it, despite their West Point pedigree. But he never let any of their insults and rudeness cause him to retaliate in any way. He kept trying to work with him every way. Of course, his cabinet, famously, Doris Kearns Goodwin, team of rivals, people who had opposed him in the election, who initially disrespected him, and yet it didn't take them long to realize, no, this guy really is the smartest guy in the room. Union soldiers during the war who deserted. Lincoln was famous for his forgiving spirit in issuing pardons to allow them to return to their family. As the war came toward an end, his attitude toward reconciling with the Confederacy and in particular Confederate soldiers was incredibly gracious. And last but not least, his wife Mary was an extremely difficult person, and always doing things that would be upsetting to just about anybody, and they certainly were to Lincoln, and yet he never retaliated or, you know, got angry in front of anybody or treated her harshly in any way. So just in one set of people after another, he was always taking the high road. And so my chapter, goes into those details, and anybody who's been involved in any organization knows that conflicts are going to arise. People are going to make you angry. People are going to frustrate you, and you can either get down on their level and go head to head and create all kinds of fallout, or you can stay in a magnanimous role and not let the water run off your back and not lose your composure and not lose your focus and not lose your desire to maintain your objectives. And so those are the kinds of thoughts that leaders ought to be having in their own little world. And I think there's a lot to be gained by seeing how many different ways and how well Lincoln did it.
And this would be a great book for law schools.
I think it'd be a great book for any history class, any law
Right,
school. There, as you may know, in the last few years, at least some law schools have initiated programs in their curriculum called the Lawyer as Leader, and taught classes on leadership tied to, what do lawyers do? As I talked about a few minutes ago, we speak, we write, we argue, we come up with solutions to problems. And these are skill sets that all leaders need to have, whether they're lawyers or not. And of course, I think right now we have about 60% of our presidents were lawyers, although in my lifetime, a much lower percentage of our presidents have been lawyers. But be that as it may, I do think that the skill sets that most lawyers have are readily capable of being implemented into leading whatever organizations they may be involved with. And this book attempts to give them some clear thoughts on how to be the best leader that they can be.
that they have these skills.
Right.
They have them. Let's see. We have another one here. Let's see. Want to expand your power into entirely new areas of influence? Do what Theodore Roosevelt did.
Well, Roosevelt expanded the scope of the presidency. Early in his presidency, for example, there was this national coal strike of 1902. And between the coal miners and the business executives who owned the coal companies. And so the country was on the verge, half the country anyway, was on the verge of freezing to death because nobody had any coal. And never before had a president of the United States intervened, made the decision to intervene in a labor dispute. And yet Roosevelt said, even though there's no precedent for this, I can't let half the country freeze to death while I'm president of the United States. I'm going to get involved. I'm going to get this problem solved. And he did. One of, in my opinion, a trait that he had that's not as well known as it should be was his incredible skill as a mediator. And he certainly mediated that coal strike, and he was so good at it that a couple of years later, Japan and Russia were at war with each other, and they reached out to Theodore Roosevelt and said, "Hey, would you come over here and see if you can get this war that we're involved with? Can you get it settled? Can you bring peace?" And sure enough, he went over there. He did. And for that, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And then he did it again with a Moroccan crisis and another at a Hague conference crisis. So nobody had ever played international mediator or domestic mediator before Theodore Roosevelt said, "This is something I'm going to do." Another area, national conservation. No president before had ever saw this as something within the scope of what a president of the United States needs to be doing. And yet, being the outdoorsman that he was, seeing that there were many commercial interests who cared a whole lot more about their businesses than preserving the environment, He obviously greatly expanded the national park systems and just a national attitude toward conservation that had never existed before. So getting back to what do great leaders do, if all you do is assume the exact duties of your predecessor and don't look for ways that you can get into new areas and make a huge positive difference, then you're missing something. And that's an example of what I'm talking about with Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay. Yeah, I love it. So, you had mentioned earlier that in the, I think in the back of the chapters is like exercises or questions or
Questions, a series of questions.
did you
Now,
pick
for
those?
example, here's on the John F. Kennedy chapter.
What page is that on, by the way?
Well, the Kennedy chapter starts on page 231. So, yeah, here we go. So
Yeah.
at the end of each chapter, these questions, I put a bold heading, personal application, applied history, personal application. You now know how John F. Kennedy would have answered the following questions about his most important leadership strengths. How do you answer them? Here's the first one. Do you present yourself to your family and closest colleagues as being whole-souled and internally consistent? Or is a more accurate assessment of your actions that you are contradictory because your internal wiring is compartmentalized? That happened to be one of John F. Kennedy's weaknesses. And at the end of each chapter, if I've gone through their strengths, I also have a section on what was each president's weakness. The next one, are you consumed by what others will conclude about your ultimate legacy, as John F. Kennedy was? Is the record of your leadership performance distorted because of misrepresentations and material omissions in the narrative that you have perpetrated, as Kennedy did? While you've held a leadership position, have you learned new things that cause you to discern, reconsider, and change your original position on issues? Kennedy was famous for this. He came into the presidency having pretty much just been a playboy during his years in Congress. He'd never advanced a major bill. He'd never done anything, but he was handsome. He was brilliant. He was ambitious, and lo and behold, he gets elected president and becomes president when he's 43 years old. He didn't know anything about foreign policy. He didn't know anything about economic policy. He darn sure didn't know anything about civil rights. But one of the strengths that I point out in this chapter is, man, did he learn fast. He made it his business to learn as much as he could. The self-awareness to acknowledge that he had a lot to learn, and then taking on the responsibility to learn it and implement it.
Yeah.
And so that's one of his leadership traits. Now that you better understand the challenges of your current leadership position, have you been fair in your assessment of your predecessor? He had been very harsh about Eisenhower, his predecessor, during the 1960 campaign. Once he became president, he realized, you know what? Eisenhower knew what he was doing. That's why Eisenhower is now rated as our fifth greatest president behind Lincoln, Washington, and the two Roosevelts. So these are examples of the kind of questions, again, after you've read the chapter, when these subjects are fresh on your mind, that hopefully will bring on some reflection and maybe cause an aspiring leader, an existing leader, to kind of tweak his thoughts on some aspect of what he's trying to do as a leader.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love it. That's great. You mentioned a little while ago. I just wanted to ask you about a book that you had mentioned about encouragement. I'm just curious, where did that come from? What made you write that book?
Well, of course, during the course of my long legal career, lawyers often were, for good reason, have not been held in the highest esteem by the public. And we had lawyer jokes, and we had all kinds of instances of what were considered silly lawsuits and lawsuits without merit being pursued, and just the general disparagement of our profession. And so I've always believed in the power of lawyers. I mean, going back to my childhood, Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, Abraham Lincoln, my first presidential hero. My childhood grade school was spent when America was celebrating the centennial of the Civil War, and lots of television documentaries and children's books. Of course, the great hero was Abraham Lincoln. I want to grow up and be like Abe Lincoln and Atticus Finch. And then I grew up and became a lawyer, and everybody's talking about Nixon and, unethical lawyers and things like that. My book, Raising the Bar, The Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society, was an effort to say, hey, lawyers do great things. Yeah, there's bad apples. We know about them. But overall, this is an important profession, and we need to recognize it as such. So that was what inspired the book.
Wonderful. Okay, so as far as being a lawyer, what makes you passionate about the law?
I'm passionate about helping people solve their problems. In Texas, at least, where I've practiced my entire career, out of the thousands and thousands of civil lawsuits that get filed every year, about 99% of them get settled. And beginning in the late 80s, Texas became proactive in implementing mediation and compulsory mediation into every lawsuit that was filed. And mediation's had a very high settlement success rate. And if you do commercial litigation, which I do, and therefore you represent business people and businesses, they don't want to go to trial. They want to get out of that lawsuit with a fair result that they can live with, but it's not going to drag on and on and on through depositions, paper discovery, hearings, trials, appeals. And so anytime I can do what it takes to get a case quickly into a acceptable settlement mode, then I've accomplished my client's goal. And I realized early on in my career there really is a satisfaction in making your clients happy by doing what they wanted to do, which was to bring an end to the lawsuit as quickly as they could. And I've been a mediator and done that many times, but I've also many more times represented parties in mediations with very capable mediators. And even though when the settlement deal is struck, parties will often have temporary dissatisfaction. I mean, obviously, when it started, they wanted a pound of flesh from whoever their opponent was, and a settlement typically does not result in getting a pound of flesh from the other side. But nonetheless, it doesn't take long for them to realize, hey, I'm back to my business. I'm back to my life. I don't go to sleep at night worrying about this lawsuit. I don't get scared to death every month when I get my litigator's invoice and realize how wildly expensive this whole litigation is compared to what I thought it was going to cost me. So, I mean, and then also you have, I don't remember in New Hampshire, but in Texas, we have partisan political elections, which means we have judges who run as Republicans and judges who run as Democrats. And these elections are political elections, very expensive campaigns, and many of the judges who get elected may be good as politicians, but they're terrible judges. And so I can't boast about how great our trial and appellate judges in Texas are, with the exception of our Texas Supreme Court, which is a very, very fine court and always has been. But over the course of my career, the caliber of the trial judges and the Court of Appeals justices, for the most part, has gone down. And so again, if you pursue your lawsuit through a trial, you're in the hands of a judge who may not know what he or she is doing. Same with an appeal. And so you have all these issues that if I was a party to a lawsuit, would be very disconcerting to me. And, you know, people who've never been involved in a lawsuit and they watch movies and TV and they think there's some cosmic justice that's going to result at the end of a lawsuit, learn pretty quickly that that's fiction. That's not the real world. And so you have to deal with the real world to bring about the best resolutions that you can. I mean, sometimes you can't get them settled. And I mean, I've tried many, many cases, jury trials, et cetera, and, you know, been very successful. But that doesn't mean that's the best result for the client compared to if it was something that could have been resolved a year before the trial and thereby give the party a year of his life back that he lost because he was consumed in this lawsuit that, you know, took so much time and took so much money.
Right. So I'm curious, this is my last question, and then you can just share whatever else you want to make sure that folks know and make sure you say the name of your book again. So my last question is, if you were a professor at a law school, what would be the most important lessons that you've learned you'd want the students to know?
Well, it would depend on what the students want to know. If the students want to know about which side of the legal career he or she should pursue, I never wanted to be a transactional lawyer. I always wanted to be a litigator. I'd been a high school debater and been involved in college politics, and I like speaking on my feet and I like writing and everything associated. But if you're a very successful transactional lawyer and you get clients who are going to have deal after deal after deal after deal, and you've got a pipeline, you develop your niche, I think it's a good way to make to have a great career and make a good living. Litigation, from my perspective, is cyclical. It's peaks and valleys. You're in the middle of a big case, and then all of a sudden it settles and you're waiting for the next one to come along. Or maybe you've got too many cases, and to manage them all brings on incredibly high stress. So I think I'd want to talk with a law student about the transactional practice versus the controversy side of the practice. I think I'd also want to talk to him about what I've just talked about in terms of our judicial systems and their defects, which I don't think are going to go away. You know, on the one hand, I can sit here and talk about all the defects, and yet it's still the best system in the world. I get that. I think there's a lot about the real world of the legal business and the judicial system that law students do not have a grasp of when they're coming out of law school. And the sooner that they understand it, the better. I mean, for example, I was a first-year lawyer as a commercial litigator at a downtown Dallas firm, working under a senior litigation partner who was terrific, a great mentor and trainer. And he told me one day, he said, "All I can tell you is, if you do have, you don't ever want to go to trial unless you know you can win. Because if you don't win, the client's not going to pay you." And I said, "Wait a second. I thought we had a fee agreement that says we're going to get paid by the hour, win or lose, that, you know, that's our agreement." He said, "Yeah, that's what our agreement says. But if you lose, they're going to say it was your fault and they're not going to pay you." Okay. Now that's something you'd never hear in law school,
right?
But it's the real world. It's the real world. I mean, obviously there are many instances where losing parties pay their lawyers,
yeah,
but it's a struggle because they're going to think something that you did caused them to not be successful much of the time.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of conversations that I'd have with law students about the road that lies ahead if they plan to spend their careers practicing law.
That's wonderful. Thank you. So any last thoughts for everybody?
Well, I hope everybody wants to learn more about leadership and feels like there would be something to be learned from our greatest presidents that they could apply to what they're doing. I do think the happiest lawyers that I know are the people who, over the course of their careers, diversify themselves and do other things and are something more than mere billable hour machines, which is obviously what the big law firms want them to be. Just bill, 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 so forth. And everybody makes a whole lot of money, and yet you don't have a life. You don't have outside interests. Often it's detrimental to family life, all those things. And so diversifying yourself into other arenas, and in my case, arenas that actually make full use of my legal skills, is something that should be pursued. I mean, that lawyer book, Raising the Bar, the Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. I mean, the lawyer is society's ultimate utility player. We are typically called on to be leaders because of our lawyer talents. And so use them. Don't just use them in your law office or in the courtroom. Use them throughout society and see how many different ways you can improve things.
And
Those
by
are my final words.
right, and but reading your book, they can learn even more how to use them. I mean, the exercises are right there, and the questions are right there, the probing questions. So that's great. Okay, say the name of your book one more time.
The title of the book is How the Best Did It, subtitled Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Okay, enjoyed it, Chris.
All right. So long, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Lawyers Tell All, where Chris Mullins takes you on a journey with lawyers in the trenches who show you the realities of what it takes to succeed in this chaotic, crowded, ever-changing profession. Remember to visit our website at www.lawyerstellall.com and enjoy even more great episodes like this one. Again, while you're here, subscribe to us via your favorite network. We look forward to seeing you next time on Lawyers Tell All.